So we're continuing our study of Sefer Melachim, and we're towards the end of Perek Hey, Melachim Aleph, Perek Hey, Pasuk Chaf Aleph, that Shlomo had just sent word to a neighboring king in the north, in what we would call Lebanon today. His name was Hiram. He had been a friend of David. He had helped David build his palace. And now Shlomo is contacting him in order to help him to build a house, L'shem Hashem, a house for the name of Hashem, which is a reference to the Beis HaMikdash. So Shlomo, at this point, feels comfortable. He has set up his kingdom. He's ready to build the Beis HaMikdash, that which his father couldn't do. And he basically is asking for help, specifically when it comes to wood. The wood that was going to be for the Beis HaMikdash was wood that comes from the Arzei HaLevanon, the cedars of Lebanon, which are known to be very tall and mighty trees, and therefore it would be a very respectable type of wood to use for the Beis HaMikdash. But you needed experts, and the experts were the king Hiram and his men. So Pasuk Chaf Aleph is now the reaction after Hiram got the message from Shlomo. Vayhi kishmo Hiram as divrei Shlomo. It was when Hiram heard the words of Shlomo. Vayismach ma'od. He was extremely happy. He was extremely happy. Why? Well, he expresses himself. Vayomer, and he says, Baruch Hashem. Blessed be Hashem. Now, whether he was a monotheist or a polytheist, whether he believed in many gods and just acknowledged that the Jews have their God and therefore he's acknowledging Hashem, or if there was something more significant that even though he was a Gentile king, that maybe he had full recognition that there is only one God. But because it's in response to Shlomo, either way, he's saying, Baruch Hashem Hayom, blessed is Hashem, is blessed today. Asher nasan leDavid ben Chacham al Ha'am Harav Hazeh, that he gave to David a son so wise over the great people, over the numerous people, meaning over the Jewish people, that Hiram maybe was concerned. He might have been concerned that David, this is many times this happens, when you have a very prominent individual in a position of power, how do you know that the next person, right? Sometimes I don't know where the expression comes from, that it's hard to step into their shoes, but sometimes it's hard to take over. David is like, you know, who could take over for David? So Hiram kind of had, and first of all, we don't even know if Hiram had any knowledge of some of David's other sons. He actually wouldn't have been so wrong to think that maybe some of David's sons don't exactly measure up to David. Definitely some of the sons that we come in contact with, even in just in Sefer Melachim, didn't necessarily match David in terms of their character. And so Hiram may have been nervous, not nervous, but just skeptical that someone would step into the throne and it would be an equal to David. And so by hearing about Shlomo and probably hearing, right, he acknowledges Shlomo as being Ben Chacham, as being wise, and maybe he heard of some of the wisdom of Shlomo, and that Shlomo is extending a hand of friendship back to Hiram, just like David did. So he's praising Hashem that Hashem went ahead and gave David someone so wise, a son so wise. Pasuk Chaf Beis. Vayishlach Hiram el Shlomo lemor. So Hiram sent back to Shlomo saying as follows: Shamati es asher shalachta elai. I have heard that which you sent to me. Ani esa es kol cheftzecha. I am going to do all that you want. Va'atzei arazim uva'atzei veroshim. In terms of supplying atzei arazim, which is the cedar wood, and atzei veroshim gets translated as cypress wood. Probably also it came from that region. In Divrei Yamim it says that Shlomo actually requested multiple types of woods, and therefore even...
Which one's that?
This is the
cypress wood.
Krushim.
Atze Veroshim.
Oh, Veroshim.
Yeah, it's called the, in Latin, it's the Juniperus excelsa.
Exactly.
That's the, I guess the...
Yeah, the genus. And the,
yeah, exactly. So why, you know, why in English, or more English, this translates as cypress. What does yours say?
It's cypress.
Cypress. Okay, so that's... That's what we're going to get. I obviously can't say we're so familiar with different types of wood. But he said, I'm going to take care of all that you asked.
Josh would know.
That's what was requested. Pasuk Chaf Gimel. So Hiram is still replying. Avadai yoridu min halavanon yama. My servants will bring down from Lebanon, from Lebanon, yama. They'll bring it towards the yam. The yam is the sea. Va'ani asimeim devoros bayam ad hamakom asher tishlach elai. And I will place them. Dovros are, the Mitzvot Tzion defines it as basically beams that are tied together on the water. What we would call like a raft. Because how are you going to transport these large beams from the north in Lebanon down to the center of Israel? So the fastest way will be to put it on the water. It'll be a lot easier. There's no weight on animals. There's no extra effort. But now you'll bring it down ad hamakom asher tishlach elai, until a place that you send me, meaning, you know, draw a map and let's say go from Yerushalayim straight west till you got to the Mediterranean. I don't know what that would be today. But just go due west. That point, perhaps as a port, build a port, have a port there. We'll take the rafts down the Mediterranean Sea from Lebanon, right? Both the cities that Hiram was king over, of Sidon and Tyre, Tsur, those were port cities on the Lebanon coast of the Mediterranean Sea. And therefore, you'll bring them down. V'nipatztim sham, we'll take them apart there. Vata tisa, and then you'll carry it, meaning then you'll, obviously, then you'll have to figure out wagons, people carrying it. However, v'ata, so that's all that I'm going to do. V'ata tases chefzi, you, Shlomo, have to do my will. You have to do what I desire, l'seis lechem beisi, to provide food for my household. Now, we mentioned last time there was a little bit of a debate. Where did the actual wood come from? Because it seems in the compensation, the actual price of the wood doesn't seem to get discussed. Both when Shlomo makes the request, and now that Hiram is acknowledging and saying, I agree to your terms, the fee for the actual wood doesn't seem to be discussed, which perhaps, right, we said the debate was it coming from parts of Lebanon that were in control of Hiram, and therefore either there was a price that's not discussed, or it was a gift of some sort, which would not be, you know, wouldn't be so far. And he had a great relationship with David, and that's continuing, and it's very friendly. The other approach is that, no, the land of it was in the north, but the land belonged to Shlomo. The land was Eretz Yisrael. The borders of the modern state of Israel today are nowhere close to the borders that existed specifically in the time of David. We test this out. I think the borders of the land of Israel at this time, under David and Shlomo, were the most expansive it ever was in history. Meaning David was able to conquer much more than Yehoshua. Yehoshua was able to conquer based on certain borders, but David was able to conquer to a much larger extent. What we call Syria today, in the language of the Mishnah, they call it Surya. So that was considered to be what's called Kibush Yachid. It was conquered by an individual. When Yehoshua conquered it, any land that Yehoshua conquered was considered to be Eretz Yisrael on a biblical level. So all of the laws that pertain to Eretz Yisrael were considered to be biblical. When Yehoshua stopped his conquest, that, you know, so ends the borders of Eretz Yisrael. When David went ahead and did his conquering and furthered the borders, it didn't have the same status, and it actually only created, I guess it makes it complicated, it created the land of Israel status on a rabbinic level. So that if you lived in Syria, you would have to keep all of the agricultural laws, but only on a rabbinic level, which obviously can have certain halachic differences. So maybe this land belonged to Shlomo, and therefore he wouldn't have to pay for the wood. He'd only have to pay for the workers. And when it says, L'seis lechem beisi, to provide food for my house, Is that just food? Is that also compensation for the workers? You probably have to imagine that you know, no one's getting the raw end of the deal here. This is very, very friendly, very, very cordial. And the relationship seems to be positive and continues to be positive. Pasuk Chaf Dalet. Vayhi Chiram nosein l'shlomo atzei arazim. So Chiram would give, right? This is like happening in real time. Vayhi Chiram nosein l'shlomo atzei arazim. He would give him the cedar wood, v'atzei v'roshim, and the cypress wood, kol chafzo, all that he desired. Pasuk Chafei, u'shlomo nasan l'chiram. And now we hear about the actual, right, what's said in Pasuk Chaf Gimel, the lechem basi, food for my house, which maybe sounds ambiguous, and I guess each of us could take our guess. Is it a lot? Is it a little? Here the Pesukim are very clear that it was quite a lot. U'shlomo nasan l'chiram esrim elef kor chitim mikolas makoles leveso. Shlomo gave to Chiram 20,000 kor, which is a measurement of wheat, that would be makoles. Makoles, here, it's probably similar to the modern Hebrew word makolet. What's makolet? The place that provides you sustenance. The shorish of the word, kaf lamed, is like kalkal, which means, right, kalkala is a sustenance. Right? So makoles leveso, a place of sustenance, or providing the sustenance for his household. The esrim kor shemen kasis, 20 kor of crushed oil. Ko yitain shlomo l'chiram shana v'shana. This was the annual gift that Shlomo would go ahead and give. And it seems to be a lot. And it seems to be in abundance. And maybe you would say the shemen was like the icing on the cake. Maybe that didn't have to be there. But again, this relationship was very solid. And so Chiram gave what he gave. Shlomo gave what he gave.
This was every year
for as long as it took to get the cedar wood.
Oh, not for as long as it came.
Right. This is every year. The Radak says, "Kol zman shes asku avdei Chiram b'malecha Shlomo." As long as the work went, we're going to see that it was a multi-year project. The building of the Beis Hamikdash and the gathering of the materials. So as long as the working order was there, so now what seems to be the implication from the Pesukim is that Chiram almost makes it sound like I got this, meaning I'm going to take care of this with my men, and the first time that you see me, or the first time that you get involved with this wood, is at whatever port city we agree to meet on the Israeli coast when I hand over the wood that was turned into rafts to be brought closer to you. The next few psukim perhaps imply that Shlomo still wanted there to be a presence of Jewish workers along with Chiram's workers, even if they needed to take their direction, because Chiram's workers were familiar with these types of wood. But you'll see as these psukim unfold. Pasuk Chavav. V'Hashem nasan chachma l'Shlomo. Hashem had given wisdom to Shlomo kasher dibir lo, like he had spoken to him. Vayi shalom bin Chiram uvein Shlomo. There was peace between Chiram and Shlomo. Vayichrasu bris shnehem. The two of them sealed a covenant, sealed an agreement, officially. You know, what exactly that was, it's not necessarily clear, but to some degree, the two of them, you know, did they ever meet each other? Did they ever have face to face? So far, we don't necessarily know that. It could just be via means of a messenger. By Yechersu Brish Shnehem, they cemented their relationship with each other. That no longer was it just Chiram necessarily having a relationship with the son of an old friend. But now Chiram and Shlomo have their own relationship, one to another, irrespective, not forgetting about, but irrespective of the relationship that Chiram had with David. Pasuch of Zion. Vayal HaMelech Shlomo Mas Mikol Yisrael. The king raised, Vayal, he raised up a mas. Now normally we translate mas as a tax. And taxes are usually in the form of money. It was back then, you know, as it is, right? It's April, as it is today. But here it says, Vayihi Hamas Shloshim Elefish. And the tax was 30,000 men. So Rashi takes the literal approach of saying, what does it mean that it's a tax of men? So Rashi says it means however much the weight, it's just it's a roundabout way of saying wages. The amount of money that it would cost to hire 30,000 men, that's what Shlomo collected. Mikol Yisrael from Klal Yisrael. I mean, how's he paying for all the food? How's he paying, right? He just took on a commitment, whatever it is, monetarily. He needs a lot. So it's an extra tax. We know that the king, one of the powers of the king has full rights to tax the people on whatever he wants. Now sometimes the people can revolt. But the king has the right to set the taxes. That's actually one of the items that when the Bnei Yisrael came to Shmuel and towards the end of Shmuel's life, and they wanted a king. So Shmuel, there was a chapter in Perek. There was a chapter in Perek. There was a chapter in Shmuel, Aleph, chapter 8, I think, where Shmuel kind of tries to scare the people and tells them, you really want a king? Right. This is what the king can do. And he says, one of the things the king can do is tax you up the wazoo. And that's like a threat, which the people didn't listen to. They said, we want a king anyway. The other approach is that, no, this was a different type of tax, right? Why is this tax different than all other taxes? This was a tax of labor, of physical labor, because Shlomo wanted, even though Hiram had said Hiram had implied that he wants all the work to be taken care of by his own workers, Shlomo wanted his own workers to be involved and to be present. So Vayal HaMelech Shlomo Mas Mikol Yisrael, he took a look at the 12 tribes and he took a tax. What was the tax? Vayihamas Shloshim Elefish, he needed 30,000 men, 30,000 workers. Pasuch Chavches, and this seems to work with the psukim, that it was actual people. Vayishalchem Levanona, he sent them, Shlomo sent them up north, to Lebanon. Aseres alafim b'chodesh, 10,000 in a month. Chalifos on a, right, lachlif, to switch, in some type of switching order. Chodesh yul balvanon, 1 month they would be in Lebanon. Shnaim chodeshim b'veso, and 2 months they would be at home. Va'adoniram alamas. Adoniram was in charge of this tax. So either it means if this was somehow monetary, so just like this Adoniram was mentioned before, and I believe he was even involved in David's administration as being the head of the IRS, the tax collection. So either it means, again, another type of monetary collection, or no, he was in charge of this system of sending 10,000 workers. They would work for 1 month, be home for 2 months, work for 1 month, be home for 2 months in a rotation.
Would they get paid? They would just be sent, like the army?
Presumably, you would probably say that they would not be paid, that they're conscripted into the king's service. Mm-hmm. They have to probably have to be fed, things of that mm-hmm. nature. But if it's probably, it's a mas, it's a tax, which happens to be the same Perek in Shmuel that talks about the tax that the king can do. It says the king can also take your sons for his army, right. Can take your daughters to be the cooks and the mending the clothes of the army, that there's a draft. So this was a labor draft. Now, why the people, why the people don't rise up, since we've had so many psukim, perhaps we've had so many psukim that have stated how good things were. When things are good and the king asks something of you that's maybe even a high price, whether it be monetary or it means donating your labor, but when things are overall good, So then you listen to whatever the king says. It's when things are not going good and the demands are high, right? Like we'll see after Shlomo, when Shlomo stops being king and his son takes over. So there was the same way that we'll see that there was a spiritual downfall of Shlomo, there was almost a physical or sustenance downfall of the people. So that, and when his son comes in, the taxes are too high and the produce is too little. So then the people revolt. So most likely they can handle. Secondly, we have to imagine that the same way we know what's going on here, we know that this is all for the final preparations to build the Beis HaMikdash. So you have to imagine that there was probably a religious fever going on, that people were getting excited. The Beis Hashem is finally, we keep talking, right? Every rabbi was ending their speeches about when the Beis HaMikdash is going to get built, but they actually had plans. We have hopes. They had plans.
For building the Beis HaMikdash, is it required that through all steps of the way that someone from Bnei Yisrael be involved, as opposed to leaving it to Hiram and his men who are not?
Yeah, so that's like, right, that's an idea. Right?
Hashem
listen, it's not Bishalakum, right? I mean, most shuls, I think, are built by, by friends from a different tribe. There could be some spiritual idea here that even though Hiram was basically implying, like, I got this, like, I'll be able to handle the workers. I'll just deliver you the wood when you're ready. But Shlomo, according to these Mefarshim, is insistent that they want the involvement, they'll feel, or some type of like spiritual, like Jews should be involved, like you say, in every step of the way. But I think that fits in. I think that fits in. Spasachav tes. Vayhi l'shlomo shivim elef nosei sabol. Shlomo had 70,000 nosei sabol. Sabol, Metzudat Tzion says, is a masa, a weight. Carriers of weight. Carriers of burdens. Schleppers. Ushmonim elef chotzev bahar. And 80,000 of those who would hew stones in the mountain. Meaning so far, we've spent a lot of time talking about the connection that he's making with Hiram in order to produce wood. Now we're used to the Mishkan. We're used to the Mishkan that was built in the desert. The Mishkan that was built in the desert was virtually all wood with a little bit of gold and copper. But the core of it, the foundation of it, was all wood. What we're not so familiar with is the Mishkan that existed in Shiloh, that once they moved the Mishkan to Shiloh and the Mishkan was now going to be permanent, it stayed there for 369 years, they switched the walls, they swapped out the wooden walls that Moshe and Bezalel built in the desert, and they put in stone walls. Mm. The Beis HaMikdash, as we're going to see in the next parak, is extensively stone. So far we've spent not way too much, everything's perfect, but we've spent a lot of time talking about the wood. Here, all of a sudden, we're introduced to the stone. And it's not only stone. So he had 80,000. So that 30,000 with the 10,000 shifts, that was all for the wood. That's in the north. But now you have this other project that Shlomo is going through in terms of getting the stone, which involves 80,000 workers who are getting the stone from the mountain for where you get stones, and then 70,000 schleppers. Pasuk Lamed. Levad misari hanitzavim l'shlomo asher hamalacha. These were all the lower workers. In addition, there were 3,000, shloshas alafim u'shlosh meos, 3,300 sari nitzavim. A sar is the officers, the overseers. Harodim ba'am, who kind of ruled over, right, rodeh, is a language of ruling. It doesn't mean that they ruled them politically. It means that they ruled over the workers, ha'osim b'malacha, who were doing the work. It was a tremendous operation. So there were like 100, it sounds like there were 150,000 workers, and then there were 3,300 overseers. The Rashi quotes from Chazal that these 150,000 workers were all converts who had joined the Jewish people during the time of Shlomo. And as we kind of mentioned when we spoke about the first wife of Shlomo, the Bas Paro, that it was a kind of a questionable time to accept of converts, and this whole group of people ended up becoming the main working force for the stones of the Beis HaMikdash. Pasuk Lamed Aleph. Vayitzav HaMelech, and the king commanded, Vayisu, and they carried, Avanim Gedolos, great stones, Avanim Ikaros, precious stones, Liased HaBayis, to be the foundation of the temple, of the house, Avne Gazis, hewn stones, cut stones. The Har HaBayis, so we know, when we call it the Har HaBayis, so we're calling it, we call it Temple Mount, but how do you build a building on top of a mountain? So we have a very, very extensive Har HaBayis today, which is much bigger than Har HaBayis ever was, that King Herod built. But in essence, the original Har HaBayis had to be similar in the sense that you need to build a platform on top of the mountain by which you can then build a building on top of the mountain, which the building on top would be the Beis HaMikdash. But there needs to be a system of stone walls in order to make yourself the proper foundation, because if not, it's not going to work out. What King Herod did and there basically are three Batei Mikdash. There's the Beis HaMikdash that Shlomo built. There's the Beis HaMikdash that was built by those who came back in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, where they rebuilt the temple. And then there's the redo that Herod did, whatever it is, about 100 years before the second temple was destroyed. Those three temples were different, and that's not even, you know, while Herod did a renovation, he changed and updated a lot of things. Probably one of the biggest things that he did is he almost doubled the size of Temple Mount. That's why there's a whole, not getting taking sides, there's a whole debate today whether or not you can go up on top of Temple Mount. So one of the rationales is that a good percentage, again, what the exact number we could debate, but a good percentage of Temple Mount is not the same Temple Mount that existed when Ezra and Nehemiah, who had prophecy, set up the Har HaBayis. And that without a Navi, Herod was allowed to extend the land. He was allowed to extend the retaining walls around the mountain to make the Kotel, which is what Herod did. But let's say for sure, where the Kotel meets the southern wall, when you go to the southern wall excavations, that you see a corner. That corner is the western wall meeting the southern wall. There's a corner. If you would be, it's probably not the best place to be because I think that's where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is, but if you would be like right on top of the corner, that's clearly not Har HaBayis. That is Herod's extension to the Har HaBayis. There's some level of sanctity, but it's not the level of sanctity that you and I would get in really big trouble for halachically, for being there. So the first, the Shlomo needs stones. Liyased es HaBayis means to make the foundation, to make the proper foundation around the mountain. Even during the first temple, it had to be of significant size in order to hold the actual Beis HaMikdash. And so he's using Avanim Gedolos, and at the same time, he has a desire that they be Avanim Yikaros. Most understand the word Yikaros as not necessarily being precious, but almost continuing. Gadol is in size, and the way the Metzius Tzion defines Yikaros, he defines it very heavy and very dense, very solid, because obviously there are different kinds of stone, but, you know, I don't know much, but, you know, they say Manhattan Island is made out of bedrock, right? Something like that. Didn't we learn that somewhere. They're stone that's very strong. And so Shlomo needed, it didn't only have to be gadol, it didn't only have to be big in size, but it had to be big in quality, it had to be very, very strong. The other Mepharshim, no, they focus on the word yakar, like we normally use yakar, nice, precious. Now it doesn't mean you can't build a foundation out of right, the biggest, right, the Hope Diamond is not going to get you a foundation. But it means, again, amongst stones, even large stones, that maybe there were higher quality.
But it doesn't say where the stones came from.
It doesn't say where they came from. The Har, they came from the mountain. They were Jerusalem stone. They came from the quarries of Eretz Yisrael. There's places to get stone, right? People always, on the one hand, there are beautiful buildings, shuls and yeshivas here in America that are built with Jerusalem stone. So on the one hand, it's nice. On the other hand, you're thinking like, you know, what the stone, you know, it's one thing that we have to be stuck here, but what the stone was in Eretz Yisrael, what did it do? I think there was a story about, I don't know if it was, I think either of Aryeh Levin or maybe of Aryeh Levin, I think his son, I think when his son was living in Eretz Yisrael, but at that time it was still like, maybe like the 1920s or 30s. So the great yeshivas were still in Europe. And there are stories of people leaving Israel to go, and leaving in America in the 1920s and 30s to travel to Europe to go to the yeshivas. So there was a story, I think it was his son, where like he was getting on the train that was going to take him, I don't know, to Turkey to get a boat to go to Europe. And he took a couple of stones with him to like remember Eretz Yisrael. And then like as the train is leaving, he opens the window and he says to the stones, he says, I'm making the decision to leave Eretz Yisrael. But what did you do? And he throws the stones, you know, back out the window that the stones should stay. So I imagine the stones were, again, since the Sukkim spent so much time telling us that the wood had to come from somewhere else, it's probably fair to assume, and looking at Israel today, I don't think they have to import a lot of stones. I don't know if it's still true. There's only one, when I was younger, there was only one brick building in all of Israel. Only one building made out of American type of bricks. What is it?
Chabad.
Kfar Chabad made a replica of 770. Okay. 770 Ocean Parkway is made with bricks. So in Kfar Chabad, we have to build it with bricks. Okay, very good. So
Wherever you go, there's a Chabad that always looks like the Rebbe's house. Like we were in Mitzpeh Ramon, there's a Chabad house also made with bricks.
Uh-huh. So it's more not just in Kfar Chabad anymore. Oh, wow. Okay. Right. It's getting... I love Chabad. That was just today in school, we have a couple of them make it into MTA somehow, some way. I don't know. It's not a bad thing. So I saw upside down, I saw this tefillin bag, and it looked like it had the longest name in the world. I'm like, oh my, you know, it's probably a nightmare for the gabbai. And then I turned the right side up it was from a distance. I came closer. So it was, you know, the pasuk that they say, or that sentence they say, Yechi Adonenu, was the whole thing. It wasn't the kid's name. The kid's name was probably like Aryeh. But like this was like eight words. So the stones, they probably got them from the land. What's interesting is that they call them Avnei Gazis. Avnei Gazis is hewn stone, which means shaped, like a, presumably like a rectangle. Stones don't come that way. When they get stone out of the ground or out of the mountainside, they look very jagged. If you take a look, right, the Herodian stone, which you get to see when you're at the Kotel, you could see it when you're at Maor Samach Pela. If you've ever gone to Herod had a palace, Masada and Tekoa also, they all have a certain style. But his style is that they had like an indented border. Mm-hmm. But it's a rectangle. It's shaved down. Now there's a great that we're going to see a pasuk mentioned in the next parak about how the sound of chisels, the sound of hammers, was not heard when they built the Beis Hamikdash in Yerushalayim. The sound of hammers wasn't necessarily present. So the question is how did they get hewn? And then this piggybacks off a conversation. The Torah tells us that when you build a mizbeach out of stone, you're not allowed to build a mizbeach out of hewn stone. There are different ways to build a mizbeach. there's the Mizbeach that exists that Moshe Rabbeinu builds, but there was time, there were times that people were allowed to build their own Mizbeach. So there are rules and regulations how to build a Mizbeach. If you're building a Mizbeach out of stone, you're not allowed to use hewn stone. Hewn stone is made with metal implements. And the idea being is that metal, unfortunately, throughout history, has been used to shorten the life of humans through weaponry. And the Mizbeach, which represents forgiveness and kapara, the Mizbeach is actually supposed to lengthen the life of a human being, both Jew and even, as we mentioned last time, non-Jew. And so it's kind of like a contradiction. You can't build a Mizbeach out of something that could be made like a weapon. There may be an idea that even though, you know, nowadays we have the privilege of defending ourselves. We have the privilege of having a Jewish army and defending ourselves, which was, for the majority of this exile, was not an option and even a dream. So there are some Rishonim who write the idea that weapons are kind of the symbol of Esav. Esav is known to be more violent. Again, we now have, hopefully not in a violent way, and if you read the you know, our humble perspective is that probably the most just army in the world is the Israeli army. But so you can't hew the stones. But here it says that it was Avnei Gazis. And also, if you're going to, it's one thing maybe to build a Mizbeach, you could have jagged stones. But if you're trying to build a foundation, you want bricks. I mean, there's a reason, right? Why is it that almost every building in the world is built with some type of rectangular, smooth, whether it's stone, whether it's brick, whether it's, there must be something to it. The physics of it must be, this is the way to do it. So the Beis HaMikdash is no different. So either it means, either the Mefarshim explain, right, you have two approaches here. You can go with the rational, you can go with the miracle. The rational approach is that, yeah, they were allowed to make hewn stones, just not in Yerushalayim. Just not in the place where they're actually building it. They had to make the stones in place A, and however they were schlepping these huge, heavy stones, which is, I mean, again, you think about it just in the times of Herod, how did you do that? There's no cranes as we have it. Okay, I think some of the, maybe the excavation, I don't know. I'm sure some of the museums in Israel have some type of the pulley systems, and they did it. It's there. It's not like, you know, what's in England or Scotland? What's that? Stonehenge? But it's not that, right? The things got there. They weren't naturally there. It didn't just show up. Or the miracle approach that Chazal talk about, the Gemara mentions that there's another way to cut stone with a worm called the shamir. It was a certain, like, I don't know if it's whatever, a miraculous worm. I think Chazal, if I'm not mistaken, in Pirkei Avos, maybe it's one of the things that was created bein hashmashos of Yom HaShishi, on Friday going into Shabbos. There were like these 10. You know, miraculous things that were created, right, when the spot in the earth that was going to open for Korach, and certain like the donkey that was going to speak, certain miraculous things in history that kind of stand out were created like the last seconds, like Kiviyachol, those few minutes that we're all running like crazy in our houses before Shabbos, that was when like some miraculous, right, it's a miraculous time, somehow it gets done. So this shamir, this worm, was able to kind of crawl along a stone and it would cut. I think you have to play the miracle card, but that's what we do.
Wait, so why don't we think they're hewn all of a sudden?
No, they were. They just weren't able to be, because we're going to have a pasuk later on that's going to basically say you could never hear the sound of a hammer in Jerusalem or while it was being built. So how is it that we have Avnei Gazis, which are hewn stones,
right.
You never heard you never heard the sound of the hammer? Mm-hmm. So that took place, either it took place outside or, again, this shamir, this worm. Whether it was one, you know, it's hard. Again, if you're playing the miracle card, then I guess you could do it to say that there was one worm that was able to cover, if we're talking about a lot of stone, right?
Yeah, right.
You have 80,000 people are involved in cutting it off the mountain, and there's going to be one, you know, it worked out.
Once you're playing the miracle card, it could be anything.
Right, right.
Why is it so difficult to just say they, like,
okay, two approaches.
In the quarries.
Right. Again, that, we got.
Why are they making it more difficult?
We got to give you.
Then
we got to give you the full. We got to give you the full picture here. Got to give you the full picture. Pasuk. And maybe that's what it means when it says Vayitzav Hamelech. that the king commanded, right? The last pasuk that we read that talked about these stones said the king commanded. Part of the king's command was that you're not going to be able to cut the stones in Yerushalayim.
Pasuk Lamed. You can't cut them or you can't make noise.
Well, you can't cut them through.
Why couldn't the miracle just be it didn't make any noise when they cut them? That's a much simpler miracle than that they had a worm.
Yeah, but you can't do it in Yerushalayim.
But where does it say that you can't do it? That's what I'm asking.
No, it's the pasuk is just going to say that you couldn't hear these things.
Right. So which, I'm saying to me, which the understand, a miracle is
which like the understand, the understanding is
it made no noise.
Oh.
Right. The understanding is that they weren't there. That they weren't there.
Okay.
Pasuk Lamed Beis. Vayifsalu bone Shlomo uvone Hiram vahagvalim. The vayifsalu means they carved the stones. That's a language that we have. Mitzvah Tzion tells us it's the smoothening of the face of the stone, making it right. We just had it in Parshas Kisisa when Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu to go make the second luchos. So the command is psalacha shnei luchos avinim, kind of like cut for yourself, hew for yourself, smooth for yourself. So Yisulu bonei Shlomo, they were built. They the builders of Shlomo uvone chiram. Some of the built, maybe there were some. Additionally, some Hiram, in addition to the woodworkers that he had, Nesilut David says he sent some more people, experts in stonework, in masonry, v'hagivlim, and the givlim. The givlim was, Rashi says that it was a nation, their name was Givel, or Gibel, and they were experts in stonework. And Rashi cites a pasuk in Yecheskel about these the elders and the experts and the very wise in this area. Other mafarshim say no, they were just it just means people who cut stone. Doesn't mean that they came from a specific place. Vayichinu ha'etzim va'avanim, they prepared the wood and the stone. Livnos habayis, to build the Beis HaMikdash. The last few psukim from Pasuk Chavav through the end, for some reason which I don't have the answer to, is the beginning of the Haftorah for Truma. Parshas Truma, which is the parsha in the Torah dedicated to the command and the plans of building the Mishkan. So the whole idea was that whatever era in when we were under foreign rule that we weren't allowed to read from the Torah, so they enacted to read portions of Navi that have to do with the portion, right? The non-Jewish aggressors understood that there's a difference between Navi and Torah, and they said to themselves, you know, they won't let them read the Torah, but we'll let them read from the prophets. Why? I don't have an answer to this. This could be homework. Why we start with Pasuk Vav as opposed to starting with Pasuk Aleph? I mean, what we're about, or earlier, meaning if you want to talk about the preparation, this is not the necessarily, why not talk about the whole relationship between Shlomo and Hiram? Why not start it with Pasuk Aleph, which is really, this is the launching point. Pasuk Aleph, Perek Vav, Pasuk Aleph is the launching point for the beginning of the actual building. The one, you know, obviously we'll spend more time on this in the next few weeks, but the one point of introduction is that the reading of these psukim give us a much deeper appreciation in terms of what the Beis HaMikdash was. Many of us are familiar with the Mishkan because every year we come back to the Mishkan and they make the Mishkan book but the Beis HaMikdash, first of all, if we have a picture of the Beis HaMikdash, either the outside or the inside, it's very much shaped by the Herod Beis HaMikdash, which is fine and good. But here we'll see there were differences. And secondly, if we're not so familiar with Beis HaMikdash, when it comes time for us to, you know, unfortunately, /fortunately, we mourn the Beis HaMikdash. It's unfortunate, but at the same time, it's a fortunate thing that we're still a people that think about what we lost so many years ago. So the more you know of what something is, so even if perhaps there may be someone, not here, but maybe someone who gets a little, you know, too many technical laws or too many measurements, but when you, it's to appreciate, it helps a person appreciate the grandeur and appreciate what was, and then to appreciate what was lost. So we'll just begin for a few minutes. Perek Vav, Pasuk Aleph. Vayhi b'shmonim shana v'arba me'os shana l'tzeis b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim. And it was in the 480th year from the time that the B'nai Yisrael left Mitzrayim. So we know when the B'nai Yisrael left Mitzrayim. It's a famous year that's quoted. Again, I'm not an expert in the years, and there are, when you go through Jewish history, and then you try to match up some of Jewish history with secular years, there's some things that need, that are a little more complicated. I think there's like 160 year period that's kind of like a little fuzzy between the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash and on from there. But if you're just going with, let's just go with classical years for a second, right? If we're in the year 5779 from the creation of the world and the creation of man, so in the year 2448, that's the year, right? Avram Avinu was born in 1948, which is an easy year to remember for us. But 1948, obviously from the creation of the world. 100 years later, it was 2048, and Yitzchak was born. Avram was told that for 400 years, your children will be strangers in a strange land. Chazal tells us that it starts counting from Yitzchak's birth. So 400 years later, in the year 2448 from creation, the Jewish people left Mitzrayim. It's fitting for where we are now in terms of the year. And 480 years after that, is the building of the Beis HaMikdash. So, just doing the math, it comes out to the year 2928 in terms of creation of the world. I'm going to take the easy road. The easy road is to just copy what Art Scroll says. Is that it says that it was the year 832 BCE. So, we're in 2019. Add 832 years. So, it's about 2,850 years ago. Okay. If that's meaningful to you, fine. If not, not. What is interesting is that this is the first time that we've had a full counting of the period of time between Yetzias Mitzrayim and where we are presently. We're always a little bit unclear. That in the Yimei HaShoftim, we're always a little unclear. We know that the Jews were in the desert for 40 years. So that'll take us from 2448 to 2488. We know they spend 7 years conquering Eretz Yisrael, 7 years dividing up Eretz Yisrael. We know that in total, Yehoshua was the leader for, I think, 24 years. Then starts the period of Shoftim, which kind of like merges into Eli and Shmuel. Shmuel was also like a Shofet, but he merges into a Navi. We're never sure. We have the idea that the Mishkan Shiloh existed for 369 years. We never have a full, we don't know exact year. Here we have the Tanakh steps out of its way, and again, I think it's the first time that the Tanakh tells us where we're up to. We haven't fast forward. We've been involved in Jewish history all this time, but all the time that David is king, we don't really know what year exactly we're up to in history. But here we see, right? It's going to tell us it's the fourth year of Shlomo. So you could work everything backwards if you'd like. And I'm sure some of the charts and the history charts do that. Because here we have the Tanakh testifying that it's 480 years later. What some of the Rishonim point out is that from this point, 480 years from this point, will be the construction of the second Beis HaMikdash. That approximately, right, the first Beis HaMikdash stays for 410 years. There was an exile of 70 years in Babel, which then led to the beginning of the construction of the second temple. So something, what's the significance of 480? I don't know. But there's some mirror here that was 484. Now, obviously, on the flip side, once the second Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, we're way beyond, Halavai, it would have only been 480. So that's where we are in terms of year. That's historical year. What about where it's happening for at that time? B'chodesh Ziv, in the month of Ziv. So what's Ziv? So the Mesilas Tzion defines the word Ziv as Zohar v'noga, like a glow, like a shine. Hu chodesh hasheini, that's the second month. Limloch Shlomo al Yisrael, that Shlomo was ruling over Yisrael. Vayiven habayis laHashem, he builds the house to Hashem. Now else, I think it's in Divrei Yamim, it says it's the fourth year. It's the fourth year of Shlomo, but it's telling us when it's taking place. It's taking place in the second month. The names of the months that we have are not Jewish. Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, Elul, we use them. They're not Jewish. What are they? They're Babylonian and Persian. When the Jews were exiled to Babel, and then Babel became Persia and Media and all of that, those were the names of the month. When they came back to Eretz Yisrael, they kept the names. Why they keep the names? So I think it's the Ramban, I forget who say it. They kept the names to remember the exile. To remember the exile, they wanted to keep the secular names of the months. And we do that up until today. According to the Torah, there are no names for months, there are only numbers. Numbers of months, right? When is Sukkot? B'chodesh HaShvi'i. When did they come to Har Sinai? B'chodesh HaShlishi, the third month. Everything goes after Nisan. Nisan, what we call Nisan, this coming Shabbos. Aleph Nisan, read Parshas HaChodesh. HaChodesh HaZeh Lechem. Rishon Hu L'Chodesh HaShana. It's the first. So according to the Torah, there are only numbers. So Chodesh HaShani, so now we know what month it is. We call it Nisan, and then Iyar. So it's taking place in the month of Iyar. So where did the Ziv come from? So Rashi says, Chodesh Ziv, hu Iyar, it's the month of Iyar. The Isbe Ziva li'ilane, the trees begin to shine. Spring is in full, right? Nisan is the beginning, right? Many of us are going to try, maybe they'll make an announcement. There's an idea to make a bracha on blossoming fruit trees in the month of Nisan. So Nisan is the beginning of the blossoms. So we're here, it was like pretty freezing this morning. So we're a little out of whack. It's not exactly Chodesh HaAviv. It's not Chodesh HaAviv yet. Sometimes it's a gentle reminder that we're spending Yontif in the wrong country or living in the wrong country, however, you know. But
can I ask a question? Chodesh HaSheni Limloch Shlomo. So did he start to rule at the beginning of Nisan?
So we're supposed to understand it like a pause. B'chodesh Ziv hu chodesh hasheni.
Okay.
Because it doesn't flow. I think that's why. Meaning you can't understand that as the second month of Shlomo being king because it doesn't measure up. He did so much first. He was consolidating the kingdom. He was, you know, becoming wise. He was working the relationship with Hiram. So I think that's why it doesn't flow. It doesn't flow that it was, right? It's Bashana, I think we skipped a phrase.
It says Bashana
Haredi. Yeah, sorry. We skipped a phrase. I got confused because we spent a lot of time on the 480. I mean, go back, let's read the pasuk straight again. Vayhi b'shmonim shana v'arba mi'oshana l'tseis b'nei Yisrael mi'ritzayim. Bashana Haraviyas. In the fourth year, it's almost like parentheses. B'chodesh Ziv v'chodesh l'sheni limloch Shlomo. In the fourth year of Shlomo being king. So Rashi again said that the month of Iyar is called Ziv. Because of nature, that nature is beginning to shine. Some say that Shlomo chose to start then because it's now much drier. The rain is definitely over. The moisture is out of the air. And how are you getting these stones to fit together? There's going to be some type of mortar, and things need to dry. There are a few months that kind of get names, and whether, you know, how the names came about, again, it could be based on things that are, you know, kind of within the agriculture. So Be'ez Hashem, next time, we will continue with the description of the building of the Beis HaMikdash.